Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My guest today is Dr. Mark Diesendorf, Deputy Director of the Institute of Environmental Studies at the University of New South Wales, Australia. He is author of about 80 scholarly papers and the book Greenhouse Solutions with Sustainable Energy. His latest book is Climate Action, a campaign manual for greenhouse solutions, published by the University of New South Wales Press in 2009. Dr. Diesendorf teaches, researches, and consults in the interdisciplinary fields of sustainable energy, sustainable urban transport, theory of sustainability, ecological economics, and practical processes by which government, business, and other organizations can achieve ecologically sustainable and socially just developments. Among other appointments, he is co-founder and vice president of the Sustainable Energy Industries Council of Australia and co-founder and president of the Australasian Wind Energy Association. Dr. Mark Diesendorf, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Well, thank you very much, Helen.
I'd like first for you to address the issues of nuclear power, Mark, related to CO2 emissions, its economics, proliferation, and nuclear waste. So that's four main subjects. And any others you'd like to address?
Great. Well, I might need more than one sentence for that.
Let's say half an hour.
Okay. Well, shall I start with CO2 emissions?
Yes.
Yes, because this has been the alleged justification for the great increase in campaigning by the nuclear industry to be subsidised for renewed growth. And this is actually not as clear-cut as the nuclear industry would make out. The nuclear fuel cycle is very complex, and it has many steps, going from the mining and milling of uranium through enrichment of uranium, building the power station, operating the power station, decommissioning the power station, in some cases, reprocessing the spent fuel, and the so far unsuccessful attempts at long-term management of the nuclear waste. So there are many steps in that nuclear fuel cycle, and all those steps, except for the operation of the nuclear power station, use fossil fuels. And so all steps, except for operation of the station, emit carbon dioxide. So that's the first thing. Now, if you take existing nuclear power stations and you add up their carbon dioxide emissions from all the steps, they're relatively small at this stage. But everything changes in the next few decades as the nuclear industry is forced to go to low-grade uranium ore. Right now, the remaining world supplies of high-grade uranium are very limited. Most of the high-grade uranium ore in Canada has been used up, and really Australia is one of the main sources of high-grade uranium ore.
And Mark, what is the percentage of high-grade uranium ore? In other words, the uranium in the ore?
Well, usually the usual definition is at least 0.1% of uranium oxide. That's sometimes called yellow cake. And then there's a sort of a gap, and then we go down to 0.01%. And this is the usual definition of low-grade uranium ore. So the uranium concentration is less than 0.01%. And there's lots of low-grade uranium ore in the world. But the argument is that once we attempt to mine and mill it, the fossil fuel use and carbon dioxide emissions become quite large. To give you a feeling for this, to get out 1 kilogram of uranium oxide, yellow cake, from low-grade ore, and a kilogram is about the size of a grapefruit or a very big orange. To get that, it would be necessary to mine and chop up 10 tons of rock. And as you can imagine, that's very intensive in the use of fossil fuel. And once we take that into account, and you add it to the rest of the emissions from the nuclear fuel cycle, nuclear power becomes a significant emitter of carbon dioxide, not as big a emitter as coal or even natural gas, but quite a substantial fraction of the natural gas emissions. And although, of course, there's been a range of studies from pro-nuclear and anti-nuclear people to get different results, I think one of the most substantial studies comes from Manfred Lenson from the University of Sydney in New South Wales, Australia, and he happens to be a former nuclear physicist, and he's actually in favour of nuclear power. He's committed to it through his professional background, but his studies are the most detailed, and he finds that really for low-grade uranium ore, the total carbon dioxide emissions are about 130 grams per kilowatt hour of electricity generated, which is up to 10 times more than the carbon dioxide emissions from building wind farms, say. So it's quite substantial.
Well, that's very interesting. The study I've always used is Storm Van Leeuwen, who I think covered the area very well. Would you like to comment on Storm's study?
Yes, Storm's study is very detailed, but it does use some old data from old uranium mines. So it's not fully up to date, and it makes some different assumptions from Manfred Lenson. For example, Storm Van Leeuwen assumes that the huge mountain of low-level radioactive waste material that's built up from mining uranium, Van Leeuwen assumes that that is to be covered in some way to stop it emitting low-level radiation for 100,000 years, basically. And Lenson totally ignores that effect. So it comes down to a value judgment as to whether you want to cover that. You would only expect, at most, a few cancer deaths per year from these huge mountains of low-level waste. But, of course, if you add up over 100,000 years, this becomes a real hazard in terms of total numbers of deaths. So you're talking about hundreds of thousands of people dying over the lifetime of some of these long-lived radioactive isotopes, even though they're low-level in the mountain. And so Storm Van Leeuwen's value judgment is that these have to be counted, while, on the other hand, Manfred Lenson's response is, well, they're not counted at present. People don't cover these huge waste mountains. And so he gets... So there's a difference in the results. If you take Van Leeuwen's figures, then you end up with becoming... The carbon dioxide emissions from the nuclear fuel cycle become very close to those of an equivalent gas-fired power station. Mm. And as Van Leeuwen says, well, you might as well run the gas. Why go to all the risk of nuclear power?
Yes, I think that remediation of the tailings is very important. I've just been in Port Hope in Canada, well, near Port Hope, Ontario, where Cameco, which is now mining uranium in Australia, but it was begun in the 1930s to extract radium from uranium. And the town, actually, of 16,000 people at Port Hope is built on uranium tailings. And of course, they're inhaling radon consistently, which is a gas that's emitted, which, although low level, if just you get a tiny amount of radon in one area of the lung, those cells get a very high dose. Radium is very soluble, leaches out from the mine tailings and is going into the lake, Ontario, from whence they get their drinking water. I met a doctor at the hospital in Kingston who is working in the oncology unit, and she said, you know, I'm really surprised at the number of leukemias, lymphomas and cancers coming from Port Hope, but really not very many others from other areas in Ontario. The truth is that the epidemiological studies have not been done. That's number one. Number two, that there's very good data examining Indigenous populations, the Navajos and the like, who live adjacent to uranium tailings, and the radium gets into their food and the like, radium which gave Madame Curie leukemia. So I think that Van Leeuwen's point of remediation is accurate and important to note. And if the uranium tailings are put back in the ground, in the hole from whence they came, they will be virtually not dangerous to the surrounding populations. I've also just interviewed Linda Gunter from Beyond Nuclear in America. The French, apparently, they had 210 uranium mines, which are all closed down, but they've used the tailings for creating parking lots at soccer stadiums, for building houses and the like, and people have only just really cottoned onto this too. So I think that the tailings are ignored to a large degree, but medically, I think that Van Leeuwen's right, that they should be remediated.
Yes, my view is that I'm certainly concerned about the tailings blowing around in the dust.
Yeah, and particularly the windstorms we had in Sydney originated near Olympic Dam. Would you like to describe the tailings pile there?
There's about 100 million tonnes, a whole mountain, 100 million tonnes of rock and dust that's been dug up that is low-level radioactive. I guess the problem is that to cover it would be such a huge job, expensive in terms of dollars and in terms of diesel fuel, that the mining companies are simply not undertaking it. However, I mean, so it is a health hazard, and it depends whether you look at it on the basis of a yearly hazard, in which it's small, or a long-term hazard in which it's large, and that is a value judgment. So, yes, I'd put that on record. I guess I would tend to fall somewhat between Storm Van Leeuwen and Lenson to say that, each one of them takes a very extreme position. Lenson says, don't do anything about the tailings. Van Leeuwen proposes a huge job to cover and seal it, which would be virtually impossible, I suspect. But the net result is the same, that the nuclear fuel cycle, once it has low-level uranium ore, becomes a significant carbon dioxide emitter, much worse than most sources of renewable energy, but somewhat better than most fossil fuels. And so it's certainly untrue for the nuclear industry to claim it's free of carbon dioxide emissions.
Yes. And what about, at the enrichment plant in Paducah, Kentucky, where our uranium is enriched, they emit a large amount of CFC gas too, which is a potent global warmer, 10,000 to 20,000 times more potent than CO2, and that's not discussed. I found that out by ringing the EPA in America, and they have all the data on that, and that's something else that's hidden. But what is the in our uranium mines here, Mark Diesendorf, in Australia, what is the percentage of uranium in the ore at the moment?
Okay, well, it varies from mine to mine, and I must admit I don't have all the figures in my head. But for our biggest uranium mine, which is also a copper mine, the uranium concentration is about 0.03%.
Uh-huh.
So it is not yet low grade, but it is quite significant. And we do know that the carbon dioxide emissions from the Olympic Dam uranium mine are about 1 million tonnes per year. And the mine is proposing to expand up to a point where the emissions could be as high as 5 million tonnes of carbon dioxide a year, which is equivalent to a small coal-fired power station. Not a small one, a medium-sized coal-fired power station. So certainly this problem isn't negligible, but in my view, there are even bigger problems associated with nuclear power, which include the proliferation of nuclear weapons and its absolutely disastrous economics. And I'm really keen to say a little about that.
Please do, Mark.
Well, first on proliferation, one has to say that the existing generation of nuclear power stations is essentially the same as the nuclear power stations of the 1970s. And these stations have all the problems of those earlier stations, their contribution to the proliferation of nuclear weapons, the inability to store at this stage high-level nuclear waste properly for 100,000 years or more, the risk of rare but quite devastating nuclear accidents, and horrendous economics. And in fact, some of these generic problems with conventional nuclear power have actually got worse. And one of them that's got very much worse is the proliferation of nuclear weapons. Because in the last 20 years or so, we've seen 20 to 30 years, we've seen a number of countries using either the so-called peaceful nuclear fuel cycle or research reactors as a basis for their nuclear weapons program. And we've seen this in India, for example, which used Canadian nuclear technology, so-called peaceful nuclear technology. We've seen it in Pakistan, where one of their scientists, Dr. A.Q. Khan, essentially brought back his knowledge obtained at the Urenco, so-called peaceful uranium plant in Europe, and used that to build the Pakistani bomb. And then Dr. Khan was also an entrepreneur, and possibly still is, which is very worrying. And he has sold on his knowledge to other countries, and there is evidence that his material has assisted North Korea in its development of its bomb. And I think the other country was Libya that he assisted.
Yep.
And so we have a whole range of countries that have based their technical knowledge on the so-called peaceful nuclear fuel cycle. And, of course, there are other countries that that we believe are very close and are also using their civil nuclear power as a basis for weapons making, or at least we can infer that. Japan, for example. Now, of course, they don't, to the best of our knowledge, actually have nuclear weapons, but they have a very big nuclear power program. And experts in the field of proliferation suggest that if they wanted to, the Japanese could assemble a nuclear weapon within a matter of weeks. They have the plutonium, they have the scientific and engineering skills. So this is a very big problem. And, of course, now that with the collapse of the Soviet Union, that we also have the problem that there's a lot of potential bomb material in the form of plutonium floating around the world in black markets, which is another problem. So proliferation, the risk of proliferation has actually got worse. And there are many more countries now talking about of developing nuclear power, Indonesia and Malaysia. And the concern is that certainly governments, even though they don't admit it publicly, recognize that if one country in their region develops a nuclear power industry, that increases their capacity to develop nuclear weapons. And so you can get regional nuclear arms races. And right now, in the Southeast Asian region, we are seeing potentially that situation. I was at an international conference in Malaysia, and the promoters of nuclear power there are saying, well, you know, Indonesia and Vietnam are making plans in that direction, and so we should too. And the whole undertone is, I think, the worry of about nuclear weapons production in their neighbours. So we should have our nuclear power industry build up our technical knowledge. And my view is that this has now reached a critical stage. And really, the only way out of it, because the more countries that develop this capacity, even if they don't actually test the weapons, the more countries that do this greatly increase the risks to the whole world. So my view is that at this stage, it's absolutely essential to put the two weapons-sensitive stages of the nuclear fuel cycle under full international control everywhere in the world. And I know that sounds like a big undertaking, but if President Obama was willing to take the lead, then possibly the Russians would follow and others would follow. And And I'm not talking about just international inspections. I'm talking about full international control of uranium enrichment and reprocessing and of spent fuel and the managing of high-level nuclear waste. And that I see as an interim as the nuclear power industry in the future is gradually phased out. But right now we have an industry. It's about 19% of global electricity generation, and it's absolutely essential, in my view, that uranium enrichment, reprocessing of spent fuel, and the moves towards long-term nuclear waste management become internationally controlled.
I'm interviewing Dr. Mark Diesendorf, who's Deputy Director of the Institute of Environmental Studies at the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia. The trouble with international inspections is that, A, the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, at the moment doesn't have nearly enough inspectors to assess what is happening at various reactors around the world. B, often they're not allowed into the reactors, they just look at paperwork. C, it could be made a lot better if more money was given to the program. And D, the trouble is that plutonium lasts for a long time, like 250,000 years. And we're only thinking, Mark, I think at the moment, of this generation not extrapolating to other generations, other political processes, other countries. So it seems from a medical, psychological point of view to be an insoluble problem apart from closing down the whole nuclear power industry.
Well, I share all those concerns that you listed, but I think we have to have a plan B. It isn't very likely that the whole nuclear industry will be closed down in the foreseeable future.
Unless there's a meltdown.
Well, even then, I'm afraid we've already had partial meltdowns, like Three Mile Island in the United States.
Or like one near New York.
Yes. So my feeling is that, for me, a priority is to move towards not inspection but full international control. And that involves putting a kind of a tax on all nuclear power around the world to pay for it. Because I'm talking about having international agency representations present at all sensitive facilities, that is, at all enrichment plants, and there's not that many in the world, and all reprocessing plants, and there's not that many, and currently there are no operating long-term nuclear waste facilities. So it isn't such a big job. The problem is the politics.
Yeah.
Problem is getting the big powers like the United States and Russia and China to agree. But it's in everyone's interest. I mean, it really is. If we had even a limited nuclear war, say between India and Pakistan, the latest climate models suggest that agriculture on a global scale would be dramatically cut for several years at least as the result of all the nuclear winter effects, the soot and other particles being injected into the atmosphere, screening out the sunlight. We'd see a temporary collapse of agriculture in the world. Hundreds of millions of people would starve, even from a limited nuclear exchange between two relatively small nuclear powers like India and Pakistan. So the risks are very great now, and at least I'm glad to see that President Obama and a few of the other political leaders around the world are actually starting to talk about them, but they're not yet talking about full international control of sensitive facilities. And I think that is absolutely essential to really bring that clock that the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists publishes regularly away from midnight, away from the critical time.
Mark, what do you think are the probabilities that if there was, quotes, a limited nuclear war, either in the Middle East or in South Asia between India and Pakistan, that by accident or severe international anxiety or the like could trigger a major nuclear exchange between Russia and America as the situation on 9/11 almost did?
Well, there's no real data to base any kind of calculation of probabilities, I'm sufficiently worried about the direct risks from a so-called limited nuclear war, even if it doesn't expand to a global war, a world war. The impact would still be absolutely disastrous on the whole world. Ironically, you know, we have the two biggest threats to civilization in the 21st century, nuclear war and climate change.
Winter and climate change.
Well, yeah, nuclear war, including nuclear winter, and climate change.
Yeah.
And if there is a nuclear war, very temporarily, it would stop our move towards irreversible global climate change, very temporarily, but that is no recipe.
But we won't be here.
Well, that's a small detail, yes. So proliferation is a bigger problem than it was before.
Yes.
It's getting very little public debate and media discussion, and it deserves a lot more.
I totally agree. Now, I'd like you, Dr. Mark Diesendorf, to discuss the economics of nuclear power from beginning to end.
Well, this is another aspect of nuclear power that's got a lot worse over the last few decades. The nuclear power always was a very expensive electricity-generating technology, and it's always received huge subsidies from the taxpayer. And there have been a number of estimates in the United States. The latest one I've seen is $140 billion US dollars is roughly the accumulated subsidies to nuclear power. And that includes the subsidies for uranium enrichment, the research and development, the limited insurance liability, the incentives to various types of incentives to bring nuclear power online. And they're really huge in the United States, and they're actually increasing, as far as I can see, under the Obama government. And in the United Kingdom, one subsidy has actually got into the media in recent years, which is the huge cost of decommissioning the existing nuclear power stations in the UK.
Describe what decommissioning is, Mark, please.
Well, at the end of their lives, the nuclear power station becomes, most of it becomes highly radioactive.
And how long is that life?
Well, some of the isotopes, you know, have lives of hundreds of thousands of years.
But the life of the reactor?
Oh, the life of the reactor. Well, some of them have been going for nearly 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you can keep them running at a certain risk. And now some of the early British nuclear power stations, the so-called Magnox reactors, are starting to be decommissioned. So decommissioning means basically taking them to pieces, mostly with remote handling equipment, and isolating the highly radioactive pieces in a way in which people can't get near them. So it's a very expensive operation, and so far several small nuclear reactors have been decommissioned around the world, and the cost estimates are quite diverse, but they vary from about a quarter of the original cost of building them up to the full cost of building them. But we don't actually know what the cost of decommissioning a large 1,000 megawatt or more nuclear power station would be, because it hasn't been done yet.
Yeah.
And in Britain, the nuclear industry was supposed to be putting some of its earnings from electricity sales aside to cover the costs of decommissioning. In theory, if they did that, then at the end of the life of the power station, it would be at least covered in financial terms, if not in safety terms. But what happened was that the industry spent that money just to keep the books balanced. And now the British public is in the position of picking up the tab, and the estimates of the costs of decommissioning just the existing reactors are now over £70 billion sterling, around about $140 billion US dollars equivalent, which is an extraordinarily huge impost to put on the British people, and that's just the decommissioning.
How many reactors, Mark?
Oh, dear, I couldn't tell you the exact number now, but I mean, in Britain, the early reactors, the Magnox reactors, we now know, were also used to produce plutonium to contribute to the British nuclear weapons program. It's never been admitted officially, but people have done inventories, and the calculation is that in order to account for the current British inventory of plutonium, they would have had to have used the early Magnox reactors like Calder Hall to generate plutonium for the weapons program, as well as to generate electricity for the grid. But what we're seeing now is, coming back to the economics, I'm sorry I sort of diverted there a bit, we are still seeing huge escalations in costs of nuclear power stations, even without considering the costs of decommissioning the power station and the huge costs of long-term waste management. So, for example, there are currently, to my knowledge, two nuclear power stations under construction in the Western world, one in Finland and one in France, and the French one has only just started. But with the Finnish reactor at a place that I can't really pronounce, called Olkiluoto, is that correct? Something like that.
I don't know how to pronounce it either.
Well, my Finnish isn't very good. But this reactor was commenced construction in 2005. It is now at least 2 years behind schedule. The cost has escalated by between 1.7 and 2 billion euros. That's just for one reactor. And in terms of economics, it's a basket case already. And this is the reactor that the nuclear industry in 2005 boasted showed that nuclear power was competitive in the market. Nothing is further from the truth. For a start, it has never had to compete in the market. The reactor is being built by a consortium, which includes 40% of the investment from the Finnish government itself. And this consortium of corporations and government is planning to sell the electricity to their own members. So there's no exposure to the market. So no doubt they banked on a low interest rate for borrowing the money to build the power station because they didn't have to compete on the market. But now it's a prime example of economic disaster from the nuclear industry. And, it shows that really after 50 years or so, the nuclear power industry isn't really a commercial industry. Mm. It is still struggling because of its dangers, its physical dangers, biophysical dangers and complexity. It's still struggling. And, of course, in the United States, there hasn't been a new nuclear power station built for 30 years, and that's primarily for economic reasons. Mm. Although initially the accident at Three Mile Island certainly caused a pause. And also the anti-nuclear movement has been very strong in the United States. But the economic situation is even worse than indicated by the Finnish reactor because there have been some very detailed studies in the United States in the last few years on the economics of new nuclear power stations if they are to be built in the U.S. And the latest one is published by an expert on the economics of electricity supply, C.A. Severance, and his report came out only in 2009. And what I like about his report is that he sets out all his assumptions. So if you don't like some of the assumptions, you can change them and you can actually see what that does to the bottom line. And Severance finds that there's been enormous escalation in the capital costs of nuclear power stations in recent years, just since 2005, if they were to be built. The components are becoming much harder to get. There are very few suppliers left in the world. And as a result, there's been this huge escalation. And Severance's estimate, which seems over the top, but is, fully transparent, is that the cost of electricity from a new nuclear power station, if it were to be built in the United States, could be as high as 25 to 30 cents a kilowatt hour. 25 to 30 cents a kilowatt hour. That is equivalent to the cost of electricity from a large solar power station, a photovoltaic power station. So the economics of nuclear power are really looking disastrous, and the only way this industry, I believe, can continue under a competitive market is with huge subsidies from the taxpayer, which has been the tradition, or in countries that don't really build them or even pay lip service to the competitive market, like China and India. In those countries, one can see them as being built as part of their blurring between the nuclear weapons program and their civil nuclear power. So even just building a nuclear power station and the nuclear fuel handling facilities is unfortunately excellent preparation for building and handling nuclear weapons.
I'm interviewing Dr. Mark Diesendorf, Deputy Director of the Institute of Environmental Studies at the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia. Mark, to get back to the Finnish reactor, I read the other day that the concrete base that's been poured for the reactor is cracking, and in some areas the concrete is totally inadequate, one. And two, people have bored holes through the metal steel reactor containment vessel in the wrong places for pipes, etc. Have you read that?
Yes, it's really horrific. and it really shows that this kind of technology is really unsuitable for anything built in a sort of market situation, or even a quasi-market situation, because suppliers cut corners. In order to keep costs down, people cut corners and put in inferior products and do things carelessly. And perhaps you can get away with that with a solar collector. The amount of damage it can do is very limited. But although I would like to see, you know, very high quality controls on solar systems as well, but it becomes a complete, you know, recipe for disaster with such a dangerous and complex industry as nuclear power.
Yes, I remember I was in America when Chernobyl happened and Three Mile Island, and the Russians said, well, see Three Mile Island, the capitalist system cuts corners and costs, no wonder. And the Americans said about Chernobyl, well, it's just an old Russian reactor. So they both were attacking each other. At this level. Now, I just would like to go on to the waste produced from the nuclear power and weapons industry with specific reference to Sellafield, Mark Diesendorf.
Well, they changed the name, of course. Sellafield used to be called Windscale, and they changed the name because they had an accident at Windscale, which released quite a lot of radioactive material into the atmosphere and into the environment of Britain. And Windscale became a dirty word, so they renamed it Sellafield. And Sellafield is the reprocessing plant of the UK. In other words, it takes, well, when it's operating, it takes the spent fuel from British nuclear power stations and also from some overseas nuclear power stations and extracts the plutonium, and which can be reused then in nuclear power stations. So that's the theory. But even under the name Sellafield, it's been a chronic disaster, as well as having recently a critical accident. So chronically, it's well known now that quantities of plutonium and other highly radioactive elements have been found in the Irish Sea, which can only have come from Sellafield. And so it is a source of ongoing pollution. But to make matters worse, in 2005, it was discovered that Sellafield had been leaking high-level liquid waste in large quantities adding up to about half an Olympic swimming pool over a period of 9 months. And nobody had noticed. And as a result, Sellafield was shut down, and some attempts at remediation have been made, as far as they can be made. And since then, it was non-operational for some years. I believe it has then been operating intermittently. It's been bought by a consortium which is based in the United States, and I'm not quite sure what's going to happen to it now. But so it was one of the few facilities for reprocessing spent fuel in the world. That is one of the few non-military facilities, or at least nowadays regarded as non-military. The major reprocessing facility in the world is in France,
yes,
at La Hague, and there is a new reprocessing plant in Japan. And for the rest, I think it's mostly military, openly military or directly military stuff. So what this means is that most of the spent fuel from a nuclear power station is not reprocessed. It's just sitting around next to the nuclear power station, usually underwater, to keep it cool in temperature terms, and it sits there for decades so that the short-lived radioactive isotopes can decay while the governments concerned think about how on earth can they manage the medium-term and long-term radioactive isotopes. I guess they could, if they could somehow keep them in temporary storage for 300 to 500 years, don't laugh,
I'm trying not to.
Yes, then the medium length dangerous radioactive products like strontium 90 and cesium 137 would be largely decayed and reasonably safe. And then they would only have to worry about the long lived elements for another 100,000 years. So it's quite a challenge. there are new theoretical designs for nuclear reactors that could be built that would have basically would become, well, moderately safe after several hundred years, which is long enough. So there's using the thorium cycle instead of the uranium cycle, and there's quite a lot of thorium in the world. But the difference between thorium and uranium is that it isn't fissile, so it can't actually be split. It has to be first bombarded with neutrons to be changed into a type of uranium, uranium-233, which can be split to produce heat to boil water for our nuclear power stations, or, of course, to produce nuclear weapons. So these new types of reactors, which are sometimes grandiosely called Generation 4, are now being discussed around the world, but new types of reactors have been discussed for 50 years, and they really haven't. They've never got beyond pilot stage, and that's probably what's going to happen again with this latest lot. They're very useful for propaganda. So just as with so-called clean coal, the promoters of uranium and thorium and coal can say, look what's coming very quickly, safer technology. I wouldn't hold my breath. It's not going to happen quickly.
It's like the cure to cancer, you know, reassuring a breast cancer patient with stage 4 progression that don't worry because we're really working on a cure for it. Would you like to comment, Mark Diesendorf, about clean coal, carbon capture and storage, what that means for the future, the technological possibilities and the like?
Well, carbon capture and storage is an unproven technological system for separating the carbon dioxide from the coal either before the coal is burnt or after the coal is burnt. And I think that there are several mechanisms that are theoretically possible, but there is no way we're going to see these at a commercial scale for at least 15 or 20 years.
So what does that mean to global warming? Just sort of paint the picture, Mark.
Well, if they are successful with this technology, then basically about 85% of the carbon dioxide emitted from burning coal would be captured, compressed, piped to a suitable place, and then pumped underground at least 1 kilometre into various types of underground storages that may or may not hold it there for in an indefinite period. There's a lot of money being spent around the world on these technologies, and so far, to the best of my knowledge, there isn't a single coal-fired power station which has carbon capture and storage associated with it. The main pilot plants are actually at gas fields, and it is actually easier to separate carbon dioxide from natural gas, and that's what they're doing, for example, at one of the gas drilling sites in the North Sea called the Sleipner field. So the gas comes up mixed with carbon dioxide to a platform, a drilling platform in the ocean, and they separate the carbon dioxide, and then they pump it down to a different level under the ocean bottom, where so far it seems to be sitting there. So we hold our breath and hope the best. So I think, in theory, the carbon capture and storage technologies are possible. In practice, the best we will see for the next 10 years are small pilot plants, really experiments around the world. And I don't think that we'll see any large-scale, commercial-scale implementation before 2025, and possibly some experts are saying 2030. So it's not really going to be very helpful in the short term for cutting carbon dioxide emissions, and but it may have a contribution to make in the long term. But then the issue comes, well, what do we do in the short term? And here's the frustrating thing, because as I've discussed in my two recent books, we actually have most of the technologies now for cutting greenhouse gas emissions from the energy sector really dramatically. In the United States, in Australia, which is a huge user of coal, we actually have the technologies and we could do it, but those technologies are not being implemented on any significant scale. They're being held back and they are basically treated as tokens. And, of course, the technologies I'm talking about are the efficient use of energy, hundreds of highly cost-effective technologies and strategies, plus renewable sources of energy. And we already have some very successful renewable sources of energy, but they are not being multiplied at the rate that is necessary to deal with the climate change problem in the short term.
Yes, so James Hansen, the godfather of global warming, the meteorologist at NASA, the Goddard Center, says categorically that we must stop burning coal now because it is the most concentrated form of CO2 emissions to the atmosphere, number one. Number two, our Prime Minister and government are directly subsidising coal production, natural gas production and uranium. And the same is happening in the United States. So it seems to me that these leaders from the US and Australia will go to Copenhagen with a desultory proposal like the one we have in Australia, which actually means nothing in terms of global warming, which will produce no results. And I feel, as a citizen, I guess, of Australia, and I'm sure a lot of people feel like this in America, really quite desperate, I suppose, about the future as these leaders talk about carbon capture and storage and greenwashing coal production.
Yes. I also feel very worried about the current situation, particularly because, in my books I argue very strongly, in the energy sector we can actually cut carbon emissions dramatically over the next 20 years. James Hansen, the world-leading climate scientist that you mentioned, says that if we can phase out coal burning, or at least dirty coal burning, by 2030, then we have a chance to stabilise the climate. That's the key thing of all the things, phasing out coal by 2030. And I'm the author of a number, or co-author of a number of scenario studies in Australia, and I've also read scenario studies by Makajani and others in the United States that show quite clearly that energy efficiency and renewable energy can do the job. But what we are faced with is a massive propaganda campaign originating from both the coal and the nuclear industries to create the false impression in the public mind that renewable energy is too unreliable, intermittent, not baseload. All those phrases are being spread in, you know, as a result of huge media campaigns and marketing campaigns through the community. And these are untrue. With renewable energy, we have a wide range of different sources. We have wind power, and wind power was the electricity generating source that grew, that contributed the most new generating capacity in Europe last year. It wasn't coal, it wasn't nuclear, it wasn't gas, it was wind power that contributed the most new generating capacity. And wind power has a huge potential. It could provide anything from 20 to 30% of electricity in the United States and in Australia and many other countries very rapidly. It can grow very rapidly indeed in China, where they're using market mechanisms, not dictatorial guidelines, requests to grow wind power. Wind power's been growing at 100% per year for the last 5 years. Each year. So, in other words, wind power capacity has doubled each year for the last 5 years in China. There is no way that that could be done with either with so-called clean coal or with nuclear power. The technologies are too large and complex. But wind power lends itself to mass production. And wind power, although it does fluctuate, if you look at a single wind turbine, you'll see in low wind speeds it switches on and off frequently. But if you look at the output of a number of wind farms that are spread out geographically in different wind regimes around the country, then the output, the total output from all those wind farms is much less variable. It still varies, but the variations are relatively small and they can easily be handled by having some backup, which might be some hydroelectric plant or gas turbines, which are just like big jumbo jet engines, waiting to come on if necessary when there is, on those rare occasions, when there's a lull in the wind right across the country. So geographically distributed wind power with a small amount of additional backup that doesn't have to be run all the time, but it's just kept in reserve, is a potentially quite reliable source of power, and it can be used to substitute for coal and nuclear power. Not all coal and nuclear power. But then we have a number of other sources of renewable energy. We can take organic material, what we call as biomass, and we can either burn that in a power station or we can gasify it and burn it. And provided that organic material is allowed to regrow in the fields, the carbon dioxide that is emitted when burning it is absorbed again when the new plants regrow. And bioenergy, as it's called, is 24 hours a day power, just like coal, only much cleaner. So bioenergy is another renewable source of energy if it's used properly. And then in recent years, we've seen a massive growth in solar thermal power, that is concentrators concentrating the sunlight to produce steam, to turn turbines to generate electricity. And the most rapid advances have occurred in Spain and to a lesser extent in the United States. And the really exciting things about solar thermal power is that we're starting to see the heat being stored. And in Spain, there are several solar power stations where they're storing the heat for up to 7.5 hours of the full generating capacity of the solar power station. And in principle, given enough land, it's possible to store the heat overnight. And so solar thermal power becomes baseload power as well, power that can be used to generate 24 hours a day to meet the overnight demands as well as the peak demand. And then, of course, the United States and Australia both have enormous potential for what we call hot rock geothermal power, that is tapping the heat of the earth to produce electricity. And we're only just beginning to realize the huge potential. Now, admittedly, this new type of geothermal power is still in the early stages, but we already have two small pilot plants operating in Europe, one in Germany and one in France. And in the next few years, we'll be seeing larger plants coming online in Australia and the United States. And by 2020, I think we'll see some very large hot rock geothermal power stations. And again, these are baseload power, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week power. So we already have a mix of different renewable energy technologies at various stages. But together, they can produce an electricity generating system that is just as reliable and much, much cleaner than the existing dirty fossil and nuclear systems that we're faced with.
On that incredibly optimistic and exciting note, we've run out of time, Dr. Diesendorf. I advise everyone to follow up on Dr. Diesendorf's last comments by getting his book, Climate Action, a campaign manual for greenhouse solutions, published by the University of New South Wales Press in 2009. And I thank you very much for this very erudite and interesting interview, Mark.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you very much, Helen.
Thank you, Mark. My guest today on If You Love This Planet was Dr. Mark Diesendorf, the Deputy Director of the Institute of Environmental Studies at the University of New South Wales. His latest book is Climate Action, a campaign manual for greenhouse solutions, published by the University of New South Wales Press in 2009. I invite you to visit two websites. One, ifyoulovethisplanet.org, where you can download any of these interviews. And also, you can go to the donation page and, if you would, help us to keep this program on air. Also, two, go to my webpage, helencaldicott.com, where you'll learn more about me and what I've been up to and will be up to. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with you next week. Goodbye.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.